Welcome to Purdue Crop Chat, a regular podcast from Hoosier Ag Today and the Purdue University Extension Service, featuring Purdue Extension soybean specialist Dr. Sean Castile and Extension corn specialist Dr. Dan Quinn. On this episode, Sean and Dan discuss tissue sampling and what can be done in season to remedy some of the nutrient deficiencies you might find. And of course, they discuss crop progress as we enter critical crop stages.
You have stuff in southern Indiana that has been tasseled for 2 weeks. You have stuff in northern Indiana that's V5, right? And only knee high. So it's just all over the board.
This podcast is made possible by the Indiana Corn Marketing Council and Indiana Soybean Alliance. Your Indiana corn and soybean checkoff investments yesterday are paying off today. New research, new uses, demand creation, bringing dollars back to the farm. Check it out at yourcheckoff.org. Now your host for Purdue Crop Chat, Hoosier Ag Today's Eric Pfeiffer.
From the Indiana Corn and Soybean Innovation Center, this is the Purdue Crop Chat. In one corner, coming in at 5.1 million acres estimated here in Indiana for 2024 and a 65% good to excellent rating, it's Dan Corn Quinn. Hello, Dan.
Hey, Eric.
And coming in the other corner, not there because he's preparing for a fight, but because sometimes he acts like the 6'4" toddler that he actually is. Coming in at 5.75 million acres in Indiana this year and a 64% good to excellent rating in Monday's USDA report, soybean Sean Castile. Hello, Sean.
Howdy, Eric.
I don't know if I should. I can't do the Michael Buffer. I can't do the let's get. That's just not me.
Well, it doesn't need to happen. I mean, clearly soybeans continue to knock corn in the butt.
Do you guys remember that? Was it Celebrity Deathmatch with the
Claymation?
Yes, the Claymation guys. And
I forgot about that.
What was the referee's name? Oh, he was like a famous ref, and he was like a real guy. What did he always say? Let's get it on. That guy was awesome, and I miss Celebrity Deathmatch.
Oh my goodness!
I think that might have been the only thing I ever watched on MTV, because that was way past the time they actually aired music videos.
Probably the only Celebrity Deathmatch reference that has happened in a very long time.
Well, I'm just even kind of wondering if Dan even knows what you're talking
I
about.
Do, barely. Yeah.
You caught the end of it?
Yeah.
I mean, that was must-watch TV. It was great back in the day. I hope some farmers are following along with the reference, because that was good stuff. Dan, look it up on YouTube.
For a history lesson.
History lesson.
It's probably on the History Channel by now.
I mean, that was some good stuff, some classic stuff. Imagine if they still had that now after the debate the other night. I mean,
we're not
going to go there. But I mean,
that
would be some good stuff.
They move about as fast, right?
I mean, this. Let's talk agronomy. I think that's probably where we should go next. This is an interesting season. I went to a Lafayette Aviators game last night, which is just
agronomy is what we're talking about, right?
Yes, okay. That's where I'm heading next.
There's a segue here.
There will be. Yeah, it's a bunch of college kids playing baseball here in the Lafayette area. Ran into a couple of farmers that I know while there. My wife was like, "Where are you? Where did you disappear to?" I'm like, "I'm running into my people. This is what happens when I go out in public."
People. She's worried that you're not there. I was like, "Thank you."
Yeah, she's like, "Where did you disappear to again?" I ran into a couple of area farmers, and they both said the same thing. Like, we've been getting used to one way of the season working, and this year it's just kind of flip flopped. And it's just been an interesting season, but things are just moving along now differently than they have been the past couple few years, and we've just seen things play out a bit differently. Mm-hmm. He's been asking me, like, you've been traveling, what have you been seeing? From what I can tell, and again, I'm no agronomist, and I'm just looking at things through the windshield. I haven't been too far north. I haven't been too far south. I've been kind of right here in central Indiana, kind of, you know, just south of Indy, up here toward the West Lafayette area, maybe a little bit farther north. Things look pretty good to me. Mm-hmm. What say you, Dan?
Yeah, I think, you know, for the most part, things look pretty good, especially around this area of the state. I had a conversation with a retail agronomist that I work pretty closely with around the state, and we had the conversation that, you know, we keep getting asked, how is the overall condition of the crop in the state? And that question's really, really hard this year because of how just widespread everything is. You know, you have stuff in southern Indiana that has been tasseled for 2 weeks. You have stuff in northern Indiana that's V5, right? And only knee high. So it's just all over the board in terms of when it was planted, which then is translated to what growth stage it's in. So stuff is so variable. A lot of the calls I have are very, you know, kind of site specific, you know, location specific issues that farmers have had. They're not really widespread. I don't have a, you know, particular trend of one thing that's widespread around the state. It's just everything is all over the board. But I would say for the most part, you know, things look pretty good. You look at the good to excellent ratings, you know, they went down a little bit from that seven. I think we're at, you know, low 70s% good to excellent. Now we're 65% good to excellent, but that number is still good. I think the good thing that we've kind of seen, you know, really this last week is that the dial on the temperature has gone down. A lot of the corn in the state is getting to the point where it's going to approach tassel and pollination, and really like to get away from that 96, 97 degree heat that we had. Still a little bit dry in spots. You know, that translates with the drought. I think we're seeing some D0s, D1s showing up in the state. But there's chances of rain. We had a little bit of rain based on where you were this early this week and later last week. So hopefully we can catch some of this moisture that's in the forecast here coming up and get that crop through that pollination period.
Kind of sounds like Mother Nature is going to ruin a lot of 4th of July celebrations, and the only people around the state that will be happy about that will be farmers, yes. Sean.
No yes. doubt, no doubt. You know, rain makes grains, what we talk about, right? It's old sayings, mm-hmm. and it holds true. And I think I look back to a year ago in June, and we were tracking dry conditions, heat, mm-hmm. stress. I mean, drought status came in early last year, and so we're just now getting into it within the middle to latter part of June now as July started. So I think that this crop has been one that's been fun to see, fun to get in the ground, and soybeans mm-hmm. in particular. I think corn's probably track this way too, but timely plantings, it was not as fast as it was last year. Last mm-hmm. year was one of our fastest on the soybean crop, but emergence has been tremendous. So you look at the time, mm-hmm. Time from planting to emergence and stand establishment, that's a storyline that I continue to talk about, has been really good. And then our heat unit accumulation, I think we've been mm-hmm. advanced in terms of, quote, a normal year, five, maybe it's better to say five-year average. It's not necessarily normal, but five-year average. And so that's allowed this crop to advance in a way that we've been blooming. I mean, statewide, we see it, but it just feels like it's more than even this number, right? I think the report came out June 30th or so that we're 15% blooming, and that's 5% above last year. And again, that's a fast planting progress and a five-year average. And we even have some reports at the state level of setting pods, but boy, I feel like we're even more advanced than that. And maybe that's just because a lot of people I talk to have got the April plantings in, and so they mm-hmm. got the heat unit accumulation. So been flowering for a solid 2-3 weeks even. And so there's a lot of hope and potential, and it's like, okay, does this early flowering, is that a good thing or a bad thing? And it kind of depends on, like Dan's talking about, what this rain's going to do for us or not.
Well, you mentioned that, you know, there was in that USDA report that came out on Monday, it said it was setting pods, and it said 1%. And I'm like, I've been hearing from people, yep. you know, for the past week or two
yep.
that, mm-hmm. that they've got some. I mean, it has been moving that fast.
Yeah, the race has been on, right? Hey, we are on the cusp of 4th of July. And so all those fun sayings that we heard growing up about knee high by the 4th of July on corn, and, you know, I've translated it to green to the eye by the 4th of July on soybeans. And, you know, I want those beans canopied, and usually that's coming in line with flowering. And again, we've been flowering a lot of this crop for a solid 2 weeks. So someone said, I want summer solstice, so June 20th, I want to have those beans flowering. And That's normally a goal for the Mid-South, Southeast, and the Midwest. I mean, you're, good luck. But we got it this year, and so maybe some good opportunities for early pod development, long reproductive window. So setting pods, that's a good recipe, cooler temperature. So I'm hopeful that we can get a good long reproductive period.
Yeah, I was just, you know, looking at last year, I always look at similarities. You know, there's differences, but there's some similarities from really the last 2 years and just how the Junes have went and then the transition to the Julys. You know, we had pretty good moisture through June, but it got hot and it got pretty dry here the last couple of weeks in the state. And last year, I would say, it was even worse.
It was.
A lot worse in the month of June. And we had state record yields, right? A lot of that hot, dry conditions that we've experienced a little bit this year and last year, right, they're coming at a time where, especially on the corn side, it's, you know, in that vegetative growth, we may have impacted some potential kernel numbers, right? That's the key word, their potential. Those ovules, right? We may have impacted a little bit, but now we get into July, and that's really when yield is being determined, right, in terms of actual kernel numbers and then actually getting into the actual dry matter of those kernels. And you see even last year, right, in the last few years, that when we have just outstanding pollination conditions, and if we can maybe dial back the temperature a little bit and get some adequate moisture in August, the grain fill is outstanding. And then, you know, yields, we get that same conversation of where the heck did these yields come from? So there's still a lot of ball game left to go for this crop. And we're getting into some of the good stuff here where hopefully we have the weather conditions to determine that yield.
Yeah, we're like in the bottom of the second here, right?
Yes.
We've still got quite a bit to go.
We're not at that stretch point and singing the song, so
no, I mean, the starters are still in, like, we've got a long way to go here,
but Eric will still ask me for the, you know, ninth inning score estimate, even though that we're in the second inning.
Well, as long as you tell him the top of the ninth, you're okay.
Well, yeah, I mean, the ESPN, they still put the win probabilities up there in the score, but I mean, that's what you know, journalists do. It's just, sorry, they want the stat, they want the probabilities. That's just what it is. Sean, you mentioned, you know, some of the old sayings, you know, knee high by the 4th of July. I think we've adjusted that now.
It should be over your head by the 4th
of
July. Head
high. I've said it needs to be tasseling.
Tasseling by the 4th of July.
I mean, that just doesn't have the same ring. We're going to have to figure something else out. Once you figure that out, we'll see about getting it, you know, trademarked, all of the things, and start the campaign. We started the campaign a couple of years ago for you, Sean. Yep. We're still trying to get it to catch on and really
green to the eye by the 4th of July. That has a nice ring to it.
It does have a nice ring to it. I'm behind this.
Okay.
I am
right.
Supporting you in this. Okay. In fact, I think maybe even last year I wrote a headline trying to get it to go.
So do we need to go like Sherman Williams and, you know, get a paint that's soybean specific green?
Maybe
we're gonna what's their saying, cover the world or paint over the world?
We've got to figure something out here, sure, to get this to take off. But again, for folks that need to hear this, explain. Let's get this going here.
You know, with soybeans, a lot of people that don't have a deep understanding think, okay, they respond to sunlight, right? And people think, oh yeah, these long days, and that's when it's transitioning. But that photo period, it's really about the night length, and we also have heat unit accumulation. So what we've been playing over the last 5 to 10 years, and farmers have been catching this and doing this, has been planting earlier so we can accumulate more heat units. So then before photo period, that critical night length pushes us over into flowering, we've developed another node or two or four. We can go from an 18 to 20 trifoliate noded plant to going upwards to 22, 23, 24. Those are just great opportunities for more pod production. Usually that earlier planted crop is more compact, and it is a compact plant this year. You know, we talked about we're ahead in terms of stand establishment, emergence, and heat unit accumulation. But when I've been looking at these plants, their internode elongation hasn't been extreme. They've been very tight early on, and what I mean by that, the early ones, you know, quarter, half inch on the lower ones. But usually by node 6, 7, 8, 9, I mean, we're really stretching out, and they're still, I'd say a good just 2 inches instead of 3 or 4 inch internodes. And that just gives me an indication, again, okay, we've got a crop that's noting well, but it's not growing really tall, so it's going to be a compact plant. Mm-hmm. It is flowering. So as long as we can get that thing closed, harvest that sunlight, that green July by the 4th of July, so we're maximizing sunlight interception, solar radiation, all that things that we want to do to create the factory to transition to flowers and pods. That's what it's about.
Green to the eye by the 4th of July. It needs to take off. Do you have it trademarked?
I do not.
You got to work on this.
Purdue's probably want to have their rights with that, too. Probably. So.
Well, I'll see if I can't get in there before they do. We'll see.
We'll both get it.
Okay. On the last Purdue Crop Chat, we had Darcy Tarspot Talinko in with us. We talked a lot about the different disease problems that we are already experiencing this season, one of which, obviously, tar spot. Mm-hmm. I have her map pulled up now to get the latest. If you go to IndianaFieldCropPathology.com, you can see that map. We're coming up on 20 different counties now. We're not quite there, but we're coming up on that now, Dan. Just a reminder for folks, we got to get out there. We got to scout these fields and kind of see what we're up against here. Because this thing, if we don't figure it out, it can be devastating. Mm-hmm. We're coming up on that time now for that well-timed fungicide application to get this thing taken care of.
Yeah, it's a great time to scout for diseases right now because a lot of the crop is approaching that tassel period over the next couple weeks. And like Darcy's data and some of our data has shown that R1, R2 spray is often the most consistent in terms of, you know, yield response and disease control for us in the crop. I think Darcy's highlighted a few more counties this week, but, you know, most areas, there's been some areas that she shared pictures with me, I think in Rush County or a couple other counties that have actually been fairly severe. They've been, you know, very localized areas, you know, kind of specific fields with specific farmers. But majority of the areas that you find, it's very low levels, right? In the lower leaves, you know, maybe one or two lesions on that crop. You know, I have my students scouting all of our trials, our early planted stuff, our late planted stuff, and we just haven't found it in a lot of places around the state. In terms of tar spot, other diseases haven't really shown up very much from what I've seen. But that doesn't mean that the weather can change, right? And some of those can really start showing up. But yeah, it's a great time to scout, you know, look at those lower leaves, look at the, you know, along tree lines, lower areas of fields, you know, fields where you've had history of those diseases are really important to start at. But I think, you know, think about the weather last week. I think that really kind of put the brakes on a lot of the disease with how hot and dry it got in a lot of places of this across the state. You know, one thing the pathologists have found really is that tar spot is really temperature driven, where you get those cooler temperatures is really what often can drive that disease, especially cool temps in May. But, you know, I think with the hotter temperatures, got a little drier out there, that's going to really put the brakes on some of that disease. So, but still good time to get out there and scout that crop and look at those lower leaves, look at those, you know, problem areas that you've had in the past to make that informed fungicide decision.
What did you say when you walked in here, Sean? Hey, good October morning to you. I mean, it's like,
exactly.
I mean, I'm wearing long sleeves in here today. I mean, I've got shorts on, but I mean, the long sleeves, I mean, it's like 60 degrees in here as we walk in today.
It was, yeah, no doubt. These last few mornings have been tremendous. And so just wonderful to enjoy. But yeah, hopefully put some brakes on some of this disease.
Yeah, these cool temps, you know, still monitor that disease. But in terms of like just being good for that crop as we get into pollination, right, and having those cooler temps, maybe we can get some moisture. I mean, we're looking, you know, hopefully setting up to have pretty good pollination around the state.
Mm-hmm. What about from the soybean side, Sean? Are we getting anything on that end?
Yeah, no, that's what I was just looking up, and I hadn't had a chance to pull up yet. But, you know, there's a good app that's out there on the white mold side, Sporecaster. And, you know, as these temps have been cooling and we get some moderate temperature with moisture, if you've got a history of white mold, this is the point. We're at R1, R2. So these are the fields that, I mean, they're going to be prime. So I'd say, yeah, we need to start putting our ears up a little bit more on fields that have a history of white mold. Last year, it came in late. Like June was dry. We've talked about that already last year. And it's like, oh, yeah, R1, R2, we're past it. But a lot of the crop last year didn't flower until well into July. So as I could do these comparison games like Dan's talked about, I mean, it is a flip in many ways. Now we flowered in the middle of June instead of the middle of July. White mold, I normally think of coming in late June, early July. Nothing last year. It came in late July. I think we're at a point now where we flowered early. They're compact, so that's in our favor. But these moderate temperature and some moisture, we might be needing to look at some white mold applications or at least protection.
I'm going to throw one at you guys. Just throw it out there. In this conversation that I was having at the baseball game last night, the farmer said to me, he grows popcorn and soybeans. And he was saying, you know, I was just asking him, hey, how are your crops doing? You pretty happy so far? And he's like, yeah, for the most part. He says, my soybeans have stalled a little bit, it seems, which is surprising because my popcorn has kind of taken off here. And he says that he kind of feels like his soybeans, like the way he follows them, and he thinks that they kind of move at the same pace as his popcorn. That's kind of how he follows it each year. And he was just surprised as popcorn took off. The soybeans haven't quite yet. I was just kind of curious on your take on that. If you found any similarities,
I have never used popcorn as an indicator crop for soybeans.
No?
This would be an interesting play.
Yeah.
Well, I have popcorn trials.
There we go.
You need to put them next to each other. Just kind of see how they go. But you know, we don't talk a whole lot about popcorn, even though Indiana is, I guess, depending on the year.
It's kind of a rivalry between Nebraska. Yeah,
yeah. Like one year we're number one, some years we're number two. Yep. But have you seen much? And I know you've talked about doing a little bit more in the popcorn space.
Yeah.
Anything there that you've seen this year?
Our popcorn plots look really good. We have five locations of popcorn. So starting last year, I started venturing into the popcorn realm. You know, we just have started with, you know, looking at nitrogen rates and managing it very comparably to dent corn and side-by-side comparisons just to see how it does, and then, you know, translating some of those management to the popping aspects. So it's been a learning process for me. I'm actually doing my first popcorn field day this year, so getting into the popcorn realm. But a lot of our popcorn looks really good. I'm working with a couple farmers as well this year. We have a plot probably about 200 yards from where we're sitting right now, where some of our popcorn is, and it's moved right along. It looks really good. It's actually, the growth has been, you know, doesn't grow quite as big as the dent corn, but at the point where it's at right now, it's been growing pretty much in comparison with that dent corn. Looks really good. A lot of our popcorn around the state looks pretty good so far from my standpoint. Yeah.
Do you do much with sweet corn? And you know, it's like starting to come off now. You're starting to see it get sold here.
Yeah. See, I think Eric is just thinking about barbecues, 4th of July parties,
you know,
and so he's
snacks.
Just going down snacks.
I had some sweet corn the other night. It was pretty darn good.
You know, usually, you know, it's kind of unfortunate. They usually put the sweet corn with the horticulture folks. You know, they
really,
kinda, you know, the vegetable people get to dive into the sweet corn.
They
research.
Take that away from you.
Yeah, they do. You know, so it's a little unfortunate that I can't. Maybe I should build up my sweet corn research just so we can have a lot of taste testings.
Or maybe I should find better friends. I mean, Mike,
you've chosen to be with us for how many years now? You've gotten two deliveries of donuts, and that's it.
I picked the wrong friends. Hey, let's take a time out here on the Crop Chat. When we come back, I think we do need to talk about wheat because it is way, way ahead of schedule here, Sean. It's like like doubling its harvest rate here. So
no doubt
we need to talk about that when we come back and where we're at with those double crop beans, because it's moving exponentially fan. I mean, it's way ahead.
I need to look at that, see if that's exponential. Maybe you need to go back to school and see what an exponential curve looks like.
Maybe. I don't know.
Oh, he's got the weasel word, maybe. All right, he's all right then.
It depends.
We'll switch spots here.
I've been spending a lot of time with you guys. We'll be back right after this.
Biodiesel is bringing value back to the farm, accelerating the demand for Indiana soybeans, increasing market value, and reducing greenhouse gases. The Indiana Soybean Alliance puts Chekhov dollars to work, researching and promoting biodiesel in Indiana, growing production, creating nearly 3,200 jobs across Indiana, and increasing soybean ROI $36 per acre. The future of fuel is biodiesel. Learn more about biofuels at yourcheckoff.org.
We are back on the Purdue Crop Chat. I'm Eric Pfeiffer, Dan Corn Quinn there, soybean Sean Castile over there. Sean, let's talk about this wheat crop. Again, it's moving awful fast. We talked on our last podcast about how quick this wheat harvest is going to be moving, and you're proven correct. It is moving at a fast clip. I believe 64% harvested at this point.
Yeah, more than double where they normally are.
Yeah, I mean it's moving fast, and you mentioned that this is going to be a good opportunity this year again. Yep. We even talked about last year when it was at about that 5-year average pace, right around I think 34% is where we were a year ago. This year again, about 64% harvested already. Yep. A great opportunity for folks to get a double crop soybean in the ground.
Yep.
I imagine a lot of folks are taking advantage of that this year.
Yeah, I would think so. And I'm looking at the harvest progress and compared to last year, 5-year average in 2024. And, you know, we go back to how hot and dry June of 2023 was. And I'm shocked as I, again, look at the winter wheat harvest. And we weren't as advanced as you would anticipate. You know, you think that in a dry drought June condition, that would just dry down quick and crop would get harvested. And we had some early harvest last year, but nothing compared that, you know, tricked the trigger in terms of the state level. But this year, you know, we're more than double at this point. You know, last week we had about 40% of the acres already cut compared to 20. So we have definitely had a fast pace. And so those southern areas, I mean, they're going to be rolling the drills, the 15-inch planters all the way through. And when you go to the northern third of the state, that's where it's kind of a little Russian roulette in terms of whether there's enough growing season to get that crop to mature. And I dare say, you know, if they've been cutting over the last 10 days, 14 days, they should have been, you know, dabbling with this double crop soybeans. I think the opportunity is certainly there. Normally what I look at as far as some of these keys and rules of thumb, especially when, again, I'm speaking more to the northern areas, that's not as common. The central to southern, it should be a pretty much a given, you know, management practice. But in the northern third, you know, we think about when do we typically freeze? So we go all the way into October. So for a typical October 10th freeze kind of deal, I want that double crop soybeans up and out of the ground 90 days prior. So you do the math. That's by July 10th. I need them up out of the ground, not planted, but emerged. And so that normally gives me enough with a double crop to get enough bean in terms of plant, flowers, pod, seeds, and to get a good yielding opportunity. And again, we're talking July 2nd right now, over 60% of the state's already cut. I think we can still roll. We got a good chance of rain coming in. So I think a lot of this crop can go ahead and go for it. If we're going into wheat stubble, typically that's dry. And so we have to be thinking about higher seeding rates. If we don't have a good forecast for rain, we need to go higher because we don't know when we'll get enough moisture to get that bean germinated and emerge. And so we have to be knocking on probably 200,000 on some of those cases. But if we got adequate moisture, 180,000, 200,000 seeds per acre is going to be fine, especially if you got water irrigation, you can water that up and get going. So I think good opportunities for us.
I mean, we all know – we all know that you're not an economist, okay? All right, we
get barely agronomist by some.
we know where the prices are right now.
Yep.
All right, they're not great.
Sure.
What do we need to be looking for in terms of yield to make this a profitable exercise? Because you said it's kind of Russian roulette up there.
Yep, it is.
So what are we aiming for here? What makes this a success? Do we know?
You know, you can start to push the numbers to it, and I haven't pushed those numbers with the latest prices, but in my mind, if I can get a 30 to 40 bushel crop up there, I think you've made money, and it's a good endeavor. I think you gain some other field advantages. You don't have a dormant field or a fallow field. You've got some active root system. I think there's some gains there. Weed control comes into play. But I think, again, with how early this wheat crop has been cut, I think there's every bit of potential in a dry land scenario, even in the north, to probably be knocking on the 40 to 50. And I think that is tremendous. You put that combination with whatever the wheat pulled out, you get a 30 to 40 to 50, you're beating 300 bushel corn all day long.
I assume, you know, when you say it's not a dormant field, it's similar to the concept of cover crops.
Sure.
You want to have something growing there.
Right. I think I'd rather have a crop growing there than weeds growing there, right? And so then you don't want the weeds to continue growing and then get that seed bank. And then, okay, if you're doing a good job with just weed control in that field, you've got to spray. So you're going across the field with that investment, right? You're spraying, you're killing them down. So why not use a soybean as a way of managing that? And I dare say that in the north, you can probably get some decent prices on seed. Some cases, you could probably even get cut price compared to full season, and so that makes it even more appealing to pull this trigger on seeding soybeans.
And on that note, thinking about this from the other side, you know, we saw this, you know, some years back when, and we talked about it on this podcast, when things started with Russia and Ukraine, and was this going to be a profitable endeavor to start growing wheat?
Sure.
You know, we've kind of seen a little bit how this has worked out. Is wheat the most profitable right now? I don't know the answer to that. It's not. Boy, that market's been up and down,
sure,
and everywhere in between. But again, I think that the concept remains the same of folks, you know, considering a cover crop or having something growing there. Wheat turned popular, very popular, kind of overnight once all of that started.
Yep.
You know, what's the benefit there? I mean, I think that a lot of folks started going that route.
Yeah, I think go back to that decision on pulling the trigger for wheat. You look at the Southwest, typically in the Northeast, Indiana, those are the main pockets of wheat production, but there's scattering fields throughout. But if you have fields that you're planting to wheat this fall, you still have the chance and opportunity. It depends on what money you invest in the wheat seed. But, I mean, if you want to say, hey, the market looks pretty good for soybeans, I don't want to cut the wheat, you can use the wheat. I mean, it's pretty common to do it. You go down Kentucky and other areas to use it as a cover crop. So it gets that benefit of green cover during the winter. You're trapping any nitrates or anything else, and then you got some carbon buildup. And so then you can go in April, May, and still get the benefit of a normal full season crop. Or you can pull the trigger and say, okay, yeah, I've got a really good looking wheat crop. I can go ahead and cut it. And this year in particular, man, if I'm 2 weeks ahead, 7 to 10 days is huge. 7 to 10 days advancement in wheat harvest means the world in terms of a double crop soybean success.
Yeah. It's an interesting concept that I think a lot of folks just, you know, take a look at and look at your numbers, sharpen that pencil, and just take a look.
Yeah, the thing with it, rotation, if you look at crop rotation studies, and when wheat's included, just overall, you know, resiliency of that field and those fields, the profitability, I mean, it does kind of put you up. It's like, man, why aren't we doing this more of this? I think we've seen some benefits from agronomically, economically, and environmental. So I think it is one for us to consider.
Is it something you mentioned, those areas of the state? Is it because those areas of the state are better suited to handle it, or is it, you know, just because, like, could we do it everywhere in Indiana, or is it just really not the best in a lot of types,
yeah,
of soils, or what is it?
Yeah, I mean, the Southwest in particular, it just has that history there. You think about some market, you think about straw market, you think about the soils. And so it's got the growing season. If you want to put a latitude, sure, the southern half of Indiana would be good, but that southwest corner just and gets near the river, I think there's just a lot of pluses that come with that. The northeast in particular, you think of these soils that are poorly drained. and what we struggle, let's look at our corn and soybean that's planted in the Northeast in the last few years, right? I mean, just that first crop, both corn and soybeans, we've struggled to have a two-hour or two-day window to get that crop planted. And so if you spread the risk of your fields in the Northeast with a third crop, it's already established, right? You took the fall, you established it, and then it's weathering the storms, good, the bad, the ugly. If it's wet up there, okay, we're managing for that. We don't have to plant that third of land area. It's already in wheat, so we don't have to worry about corn or soybeans. We can get out there quickly, and so I think that's a major play for that northeast area.
Very good. Back to corn and soybeans now. Let's talk a little bit about nutrients. Any issues there as the season's gone along, Dan? You know, we talk a lot about, you know, making sure we have the nutrients we need as the season begins, but we need to pay attention to that as the season goes along.
Yeah, nothing too major on the corn side. Sulfur, really, probably the last couple of weeks, it's usually always that time period, right, when we get into that root transition period for corn, you know, V3, V4, up to V6, where we see, you know, a fair amount of sulfur deficiency showing up. We saw some in our, you know, Sean's done this in soybeans. I'm doing some of this work this year in corn and in cover crop systems, right, to grass cover crops like sugar rye. They can immobilize not only nitrogen but sulfur as well. So we had some sulfur deficiencies showing up in those plots. So I had some calls in kind of cover crop environments that had some S deficiencies that showed up, you know, fairly early in the season. A lot of that has gone away. So not a lot of issues that have come across my desk in terms of nutrient deficiencies in corn around the state.
Gone away. So managed or like naturally went away?
Both. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So I think, you know, a lot of farmers from the sulfur side do manage their sulfur at side dress timing. So the farmers that I had gotten calls on or had pictures sent to me actually did apply either dry AMS or ammonium thiosulfate at side dress. So a lot of those S deficiencies did go away. Another side of that, too, is that when that root system got established and we had some of that adequate mineralization from that soil, a lot of that and those deficiencies did go away as well. So it was kind of both on both sides. So managed and went away just from the root establishment and the overall environmental conditions. But, yeah, a lot of it, you know, not showing up in terms of nutrient deficiencies. We can get into, you know, tissue samples, right? A lot of tissue samples being taken. I'm always very cautious on tissue samples, right? I know there's a lot of folks that take them. They're doing the weekly tissue sampling, right? Tissue samples, you know, depends on the nutrient, right? We have, you know, pretty good recommendations and sufficiency range, you know, ranges for kind of the macronutrients, right? The nitrogens, the phosphorus, more P and K and S. But you get into the micronutrients, right? It's really, really challenging. One, it's super hard to get sufficiency ranges for those nutrients because you have to do research to get those sufficiency ranges. And it is very, very challenging to find spots really in the Midwest where you get responsiveness to a boron, to a zinc. You know, we have spots in the state with manganese deficiencies. But it's really, really challenging. And often with tissue samples, right, they're a tool. They can be useful in instances, but you have to be cautious with them. You have to be cautious with the results, right? Because it can depend on when you take them, what leaf you took them from, what plant part you took them from, what growth stage that plant was at, right? You can have dilution of those nutrients showing up based on conditions or growth stages. I remember I've taken, you know, tissue samples during the in-season rapid growth phase in corn, and every nutrient came back deficient, right? And if I'm a fertilizer salesman, heck yeah, no doubt, let's supply everything under the sun. But you know, it's a tool, right? And we often recommend, you know, combine it with a soil test, you know, take it from the good areas and the bad areas for a comparison. So it's a tool, they're useful. I would say on the corn side, R1 is a great time to take tissue samples just to get an overall status of the crop for this year. It's challenging because you can't really do much with those just in season in terms of management. But really from the sulfur side, a lot of our, you know, P&K, those different nutrients, R1 tissue samples, ear leaf tissue samples of that crop often tend to be our most accurate. But again, you just have to be cautious with those tissue samples because a lot of times they can give you deficiencies on magnesium, boron, right? And these nutrients that we just hardly ever see responses to, if at all, in the state. So just, you know, it's a tool. It's a snapshot in time. Just be cautious with some of those tissue samples.
Yeah, and in another life, I spent a couple of years in a tissue lab and nutrient recommendations, and it is interesting to see the fluctuation in nutrients based on the time of the day, the growth stage, the stressful condition. Mm-hmm. I still think there's a nice play for it. But I'll give an example to kind of continue your thought, Dan. Mm-hmm. I worked in the Southeast, and cotton's huge tissue sampling programs, so both the leaves and the petioles. And so managing nitrogen and potassium. And if it got drought stress and they were taking it in, taking the samples in the afternoon versus morning, because by the afternoon they're wilting up. So you think about the analogy would be, you know, corn's rolling up by the afternoon. Soybeans are flipping over, seeing the silver gray colors, or they're even starting to clamp. So that water stress, that's affecting movement of the nutrients. And so we would get potassium deficiencies every single time when we had samples that are coming in the afternoon. And I see this in soybeans from time to time too. So be mindful, I guess. Use it as a tool. Be consistent. We talk about be consistent with soil sampling because we're always going to take it in the fall. We're always going to take it in the spring. Don't keep mixing those two up, right? So the same thing with leaf sampling. If you're doing that, stay consistent, or have your crop scout be consistent. They're taking them while it's a healthy, actively growing crop. If it's starting to show any kind of drought stress, tap the brakes. You're going to get some really weird numbers on that. Now, in terms of what we've been seeing on the soybean front, echoing a little bit on the sulfur issues that are popping up on some of this cover crop ground. I've got the trial again that you alluded to. It's showing up again in those spots of just immobilizing that extra carbon in the systems, immobilizing the sulfur, and having a little bit of effect on our nitrogen supply because sulfur is needed as a cofactor for nodulation. So those we've been able to correct a little bit. Manganese has been popping up. So in our typical areas, we think about the Northwest, we have some pockets, but then I also have some depressional areas, even on good ground, that soil test levels look good. We're going to see some manganese deficiencies. So that's one that's easy to identify, as well as take the leaf sample to confirm and then do the foliar applications and correct. One step further with taking leaf samples, grow stage it, know exactly when you're doing it. If you're going to do a couple, two or three, it's nice to track it. I like if you're just doing a one and done, ours is going to be this typical R2 to R3. So pretty much where we're at right now. A lot of the crop that's coming into flowering and R2, full bloom, it's where you get flowers, the upper two nodes. You're going to take that most recent mature leaf. That's usually about the third trifoliate from the top, maybe fourth, depending on what you're counting for. And send that in, and it gives you that snapshot. I like that to see, okay, what's the status of the crop. I also say, if you got some odd spots, take the odd spot by itself and take the good spot or the better spot and compare. Because we talked about nutrient sufficiencies. We do have some, quote, critical levels. But I've got I'll use sulfur as an example on this one. A lot of years on this on soybeans that we have not been below the critical sulfur level with the leaf samples we've taken. But when you look at the untreated control, that poorer looking area of particular trials, because it's sulfur deficient versus the other, they were just so much lower in terms of their sulfur concentrations, though you had the litmus paper to compare to. So have something to compare to, a good, poor, and go from there.
You're listening to Purdue Crop Chat, brought to you by your Indiana Corn and Soybean Checkoff Organizations. Visit yourcheckoff.org.
Silly question. And you can say, Eric, there's no such thing as a silly question.
Oh, I'm not.
Just
for
you know.
You know.
Silly people who ask questions.
We know every question that comes from you.
There we go.
There you go.
Who does these tissue samples? Is it, you know, an unbiased person? Is it companies? Who actually does the sampling?
Oh, I think you have all of it. You have a farmer that's going to be active doing. They've got their own people. They've got a crop scout that's doing. We've got ag retailers. We've got nutrient suppliers. So any and all.
Okay, because you know that's my question is, you know, you have to have someone that you trust doing this stuff, right? Mm-hmm. Because you know, you get this in all walks of life, regardless of what it is you're testing. If you've got someone testing who just so happens to be selling stuff,
yep,
you know, they might be a little biased.
Sure.
You really need this stuff. Mm-hmm. You know, that's a big part of the business and how it works. And you're talking about, you know, take a little caution here because we don't see a response to everything. I think that's probably a big point to take away, and knowing what your crops are actually going to show a response to in season.
Yeah, I think, you know, the comparisons, right, are great, you know, and that can be challenging, right, because you might not always see something that, you know, that's where that routine looks a difference.
You just do it.
They have the routine ones, but again, you know, it's kind of back to some of the, you know, more challenging micronutrients like the magnesiums, the borons. You know, I have farmers that will tell me, I had side dress magnesium this year because it was low in my tissue test. It's like, oh my goodness, you know, I can spend your money for you if you want. You know, it's just be cautious of those. And it's also back to, you know, to the point of how these sufficiency ranges are made in these labs and at the universities and determined, right? And to be able to do really good sufficiency ranges, I would say we have good ones on some of the, you know, the P's, the K's, the S's, right? And you got to have a lot of research and a lot of sites and tissue samples where a lot of those, the borons, the magnesiums are low. But the challenge with that is that really in the Midwest, it's really, really hard to ever get those nutrients that are, you know, lower where we're going to see a yield response. So that, you know, that's part of it as well. But, you know, just it's a tool, right? And they can be helpful in a lot of ways. But, you know, I always just say, you know, caution to the wind with some of those tissues.
You're going to throw caution to the wind?
Yeah.
Oh, man, I don't know about that. No, I want to just echo a couple things and further a point. So both of our crops, we said, you know, here's a good target if you're going to just do one, right? And I think there's a reason that we have decent sufficiency ranges, nutrient sufficiency ranges with soybean R2, R3, so full bloom, beginning pod. You talked about R1 on the corn crop. So we have those connections. But then also, if there is a need, corrective action still can be done in a timely way, right? Mm-hmm. So I think about an R2 soybean. All right, we've got that turnaround of a couple days. And if we're going to do some foliar sprays of foliar protection, R3 is coming up. And so then you could do a nice tank mix if that, or it's just, you know, I just do the nutrient solution alone and go. Corn, similar way, right? Whether it's doing any fungicide foliar protection with diseases, or it's like, okay, I do have the ability, or my program is high clearance. Maybe I can go that route depending on the nutrient.
Yeah. Yeah, I think, you know, the big thing with corn, right, is just the, you know, often we take a lot of our, at least in my research program, we do a lot of our tissue analysis at R1, but it's just what can you do after R1? You know, we do, you know, some work at V5, right, and when corn's about knee-high, and we often at that time we recommend taking the whole plant at that point in time just to get a little bit better accuracy on those nutrient levels. But even with our V5 data, right, it's a lot more variable at that time in comparison to R1. And also when we, you know, we do see responses to some of these applications or these nutrient applications, and a lot of times they're much more tailored to that R1, where that R1 increased or is above that critical level that we determined, then we saw that yield response, right?
I think another point, I didn't realize we were going to do this, and Eric, you're going to roll your eyes, we're going to talk another 20 minutes on it, but I think understanding where the crop is at with those samples is critical, right? So you know your crop, or your crop consultant knows it. Is it actively growing? Is this just a routine, but, you know, something looks stressful in that field, to have that note, or, no, this crop looks tremendous, it's growing great. I want to go back to what Dan talked about. You can get this dilution effect that both crops, any crop, can grow so fast that you actually have a dilution. You have less nutrients packed in because it's growing so fast. So essentially you look at a soybean plant, you go to the top of the plant, the very young rolled up leaves, you go to the next node down, it's a little bit size of a half dollar, you know, Dan's about that big if you don't know what half dollar is.
another history lesson
to my list. Grandpa always gave me a half dollar, right?
Look it up on YouTube. Yeah.
Right. And so look at the color of that. It's got a bright green sheen to it. Kind of put your fingers on top and the bottom like you're doing a piece of paper, and you can feel how thin that is. And you go to the next layer down, it's a little bit bigger, a little darker green, and you can see that change in chlorophyll content. That's a change in nutrients. But then if you're growing so fast, it's not having enough cell expansion and stacking of cells in the leaves that they're actually paper thin, right? There's just not enough dry matter there, and it's just very thin, so it's imbalanced in a way, or it's diluted is what we talk about when this grows so fast. So be mindful of that, and if you do have a really good looking crop and it's growing fast and it comes back deficient in a number of nutrients, Dan, what do you do with that information?
What's that in terms of?
Do you act on that that deficient number, or say, I know I've got a crop that's going really well. Do I just tap the brakes, say, I'm going to come back in a week and say, is it showing up deficient again? Like give that crop some time to kind of catch up, if you will, and really accumulate the nutrients and say, okay, it was just that phase. I was growing so fast and it just hadn't packed in the nutrients yet.
It's kind of like you're making him play Dr. Phil here. Am I going to give it a moment to work itself out or do I intervene now? That's the best Dr. Phil I've got.
So that's pretty pitiful.
I would, you know, in the rapid growth phase, I would pump the brakes a lot of times because it's often very common that you see that dilution come back. And I even remember I was an intern, undergrad intern, took tissue samples, right? I had a project as an intern where I took tissue samples every week through the rapid growth phase. And I remember telling my internship advisor, I was like, every nutrient is deficient. Like, what is going on, right? And it just was that dilution aspect. So that's where I'm back to being cautious, especially in the rapid growth phase when that crop is really growing.
So what is that rapid growth phase for corn?
The vegetative prior, I would say from about stand establishment, V6, knee high, all the way up to tassel, where that corn is just moving. So a lot of the corn across the state is in that period right now. So I'm always cautious, unless you're really truly kind of seeing differences or seeing that nutrient deficiency be pretty prevalent in the state, it's challenging, right? Mm-hmm. It's really, really challenging. A lot of the high yield guys, you'll talk to them, they take tissue samples every week. Yep. They're making applications every week or 2 weeks of this nutrient and that nutrient. I mean, if you want to, you can, but sure. I mean, I would really put caution to it when that crop's really growing.
I mean, those are the ones that are maybe participating in the high yield contests and are, looking to get some hardware, right? Yeah. They're spoon feeding their babies. Yeah. That's what they're doing, right?
I mean, but I think there's some other things that come in if you're sampling every week. It's interesting to track that. I mean, it's just kind of fun in a way. I mean, just take a little bit of time if you want to do that. If you are doing corrective action, or maybe it's not corrective, it's just you're making nutrient applications based on that, maybe not needed as far as corrective action, know the nutrient that you're applying and know the mechanism in terms of, or if you don't know that, talk to your ag retailer, whoever, your consultant, say it's a manganese. That's a nutrient that's immobile in the plant. And so you're going to just see it in that upper zone and that's it. And then you're going to be 3 weeks later, it could potentially be deficient again. Or it's nitrogen. It moves through the system, right? But are you foliarly applying it? Are you soil applying it? And then how long does it take for that crop to get it, right? When I think of most foliar applications of nutrients on soybean, corn that matter too, back in my days with that, if I want to see if it had a response enough, other than just visually, I'm waiting a good 10 to 14 days of active uptake and then leaf development, and then to take the leaf sample and say, have I changed anything? So be mindful of that if you're doing those kind of applications. At least that's my 2 cents.
Mm-hmm. Let it grow.
Let it grow. Let it blossom.
Let it do its thing.
Self-reflections with Eric Pfeiffer.
That Dr. Phil was really bad, wasn't it? I might have to go back and listen to that. It was really bad.
It was really bad.
Final thoughts here as we wrap up today's Purdue Crop Chat.
Yeah, I think, we're getting into really critical stages for the corn crop in terms of pollination, right? It's just...
I'm sorry, that sounded really dire. I mean, it sounded like you were delivering some really bad news to someone in a hospital room. We're really entering some critical stages right now. Like I thought you were telling me someone was dying.
It's not you, it's me.
We're just entering the most important time of its life, that corn crop's life. So
he had a smile on his face while he was saying it, but I still felt like he was giving me really bad news. Oh. Continue, Dan. I'm sorry.
This podcast may have gone off the rails. But yeah, the corn crop, a lot of it's coming into pollination. It's such an important time for that corn plant and its life cycle. So it's a great time to monitor things. You know, we talk about, you know, nutrient levels and looking at nutrient deficiencies, you talk about disease, right, and making fungicide applications if you need to at this point in time. But it's a really important time because this is when, you know, actual yield is being made. So I think there's a lot of really good potential out there, you know, across the state. You know, hopefully we can keep temperatures down a little bit, maybe get some moisture in a lot of part of the state just to carry us through that pollination window and get us into that grain fill period. But you know, a lot of the crop around the state looks good, and you know, that's the case. It's variable, but a lot of it does look good around the state, and I think, you know, it's setting up pretty good to get into that pollination period. But it's a really important time, right? We always say if you have cloudy days or, you know, you look at it wrong, right, you might lose some of that yield potential at this point in time. But, you know, for the most part, a lot of the crop looks good. A lot of it's entering that pollination period, especially that earlier planted stuff, southern Indiana as well. So we'll see what happens with pollination. And if we have good pollination, what we've seen the last couple of years, it just sets us up really, really well to have good yields.
And I'm gonna hold you at 204. That's where we're at.
Yep, staying okay. There.
All right.
Soybeans, it's a fun time of the year. I think this is one that we look at this crop in particular in 24. It's flowered early. It's flowering early. I think that we have a good opportunity for that long reproductive period. We go out there and beans that are flowering at the top, you know, R2, full bloom. Count those trifoliate nodes and go up to plant and say, how many do we have there? We've usually accumulated about half of our trifoliate nodes. And so if we have a conservative average 18 trifoliate nodes by the end of the season, that's fair. But boy, if we have an opportunity to get upwards in the 20s, 21, 22, 23, 24, that's as high as I've ever gotten. At this point in the year, if you are two, you count those nodes and you've got 10, you've got half of them, double it, you're going to have a 20-noded crop by the end of the season. And that's a really good opportunity for yield potential. So you talk about the yield potential in terms of, you know, pollination coming up. Yield potential for us on the soybean front is, okay, the positions, the node positions, so then we can have flowers that develop pods and seeds. So get out there, take a look at that crop, see how advanced we are in terms of that nodal development. And be mindful of, okay, you are flowering earlier than you have in the past 5 years. Certainly, if you've just got 1 year memory on like a betta fish here, we flowered late last year. This crop in 24 is not the same. It is definitely a different crop in terms of its flowering pattern and time of the year. So be out there to be scouting for insects, diseases, white molds, one to kind of start looking for right at this point because that R1, R2, and then be ready if you've got conditions that are going to be conducive for some of the other diseases we think about coming in R3, R4.
Enjoy the 4th of July. Sit there and watch that rain make grain while all of the kids are upset their fireworks can't go off in this rain.
You just go make slip and slides and you'll be fine.
There you go. That'll work great. Enjoy the 4th, and we'll get back together. We'll do this Purdue Crop Chat thing again here soon. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This has been Purdue Crop Chat, a regular series featuring Purdue Extension's Dr. Dan Quinn and Dr. Sean Castile, made possible by the Indiana Corn and Soybean Checkoffs, the Indiana Corn Marketing Council, and the Indiana Soybean Alliance. The Checkoffs are pleased to help bring you agronomy insights from Purdue Extension. Opinions on the podcast are those of the host and guests and not those of the sponsor. Purdue Crop Chat is a service of Purdue University Extension and Hoosier Ag Today. Timely, relevant, credible.